Shortly thereafter came another group from New Avalon. Kay's longtime 3WA partner and current IPO field partner when missions came along that required two Experts of Justice level field agents, Yuri Daniels, Genom executive Larry R-Type Mann, their 5-year-old daughter Afra, and R-Type's Mutt and Jeff Red Legion bodyguards, burly Charlie Kowalski and wiry Louis Ferretti. As she was reintroduced to R-Type and met his daughter for the first time, Utena filed this away as another of the domestic oddities of the extended Hutchins, Morgan, Daniels, whatever, family web. So, the girl with the horns was R-Type's adult daughter, by Danny, Tom's wife's elder sister, Sylvie was Megazone and Yuri's, and Afra here was R-Type and Yuri's. Okay. And she thought she'd needed a scorecard last year? Zoner sloped out of the crowd, having divested himself of the Santa cap at some point, the pom-pom was sticking out of one of his coat pockets, and greeted the pack of them effusively. He shook R-Type's hand and told him with a grin, "Only you would wear a suit to a Christmas party." "I like this suit," R-Type protested, smoothing his lapels. "It's regal and manly." Zoner laughed, clapped Kowalski and Ferretti on the shoulders, then kissed Yuri before crouching down and exchanging friendly greetings with Afra. Rihanna, over by the canapé table, noticed that her father had arrived and came over to greet him, Hylian sidekick in tow. Just before 8, just, in fact, as Griffin and Belle were emerging from the kitchens to announce that dinner was ready, the last expected contingent arrived, and even in this crowd they made quite a splash. 6 women in rather old-fashioned uniforms, with swallowtail jackets, each of a different bright color, cravats, several carrying weapons, a lone man in a uniform similar to the women's, and a teenage girl in a very formal kimono. The women were all youthful and lovely, 2 blondes, a redhead, one with black hair. The younger girl had black hair, too, and looked a lot like her. Sisters, perhaps? A brunette, and one, a humanized Seleucian, with a mop of bright purple drawn down in a thick pair of plaits. She was the only violet-haired person Utrina could remember having seen since Anthe, and it was a totally different shade. Anthe's was a very deep violet, in some lights almost indigo. This girl's was very bright, a shade that could only be called purple. The man was at a graceful middle age, perhaps 70, his black hair going gray at the temples. He had a cheerful, handsome face and very bright eyes, and one of the raven-haired girls on each arm. Griffin blinked, blinked again, and then bounded over to them, his arms wide. "Well, I'll be damned," he declared. "I didn't think you guys were going to make it." "What, missed the first one of these you've had in years?" said the redhead. "Are you whack?" She scanned the crowd, blinked, said, "Ah!" and sprang past her host with a hasty, "Excuse me, Captain," making a beeline for Moose McEckard, whom she blindsided with a flying body check that nearly sent him through the nearest of the room's tall, vaulted windows. "What the—" he began, then saw his attacker and grinned. "Well, howdy," he remarked. And then Moose McEckern, the soul of gentleness, a man whose friends all knew he abhorred violence, reared back and punched her in the stomach. She rolled back from the blow with the easy grace of an experienced fighter, as the crowd of guests suddenly parted, leaving a large, raggedly circular opening for the combat to take place. Some of the guests seemed inclined to break it up, but Griffin grinned and shook his head. Confused, his other guests subsided and let the two of them fight it out. Utena especially seemed inclined to get involved, but Kate put a hand on her forearm and smiled her little smile, her eyes twinkling, and that was enough for Utena, even if it didn't make any sense. It was a curious little brawl. The broad-shouldered redhead didn't use the martial skill her movements clearly announced that she possessed, and Moose didn't use anything like his full strength. They knocked over a few chairs at one of the unoccupied dining tables, but were careful to stay clear of the buffet. At one point, Moose grabbed one of the decorative shields from the wall and clobbered his assailant with it, making a great bong sound that filled the curiously hushed room. The redhead reeled, then grinned, swept his legs out from under him, caught the shield as he dropped it, scooped him onto it like a pancake on a spatula, and slammed him face down onto the floor with the shield on his back. That seemed to be some kind of signal for the combat to end. The redhead stepped back, dusting off her hands with a big grin on her face, and Moose shrugged off the shield, climbed to his feet, hung it back up, and then turned to face her.
"The Honorable J. Maurice McEachern IV,"
he informed her cordially, as if they hadn't just been trying to beat the daylights out of each other.
"Kana Kirishima," replied the redhead. "Nice to meet you. From the Buckminster City McEacherns?"
Moose nodded. "Friends call me Moose." He grinned. "I don't have to ask which Kirishima family."
Kana grinned back. "Yeah, I guess not. Get you something to drink?"
"Well, that went well," Griffin observed.
Utena gave him a funny look.
"What the hell?" she asked.
He grinned. "When greeting their own kind," he informed her, "Hoffmanites prefer greetings which make more of an impression than a simple handshake."
"They were just saying hello?"
The auburn-haired woman in the purple jacket smiled and said, with feigned haughtiness which was so well feigned that Utena didn't realize it was for a moment,
"Barbarians, a lot of them."
Still grinning, Griffin said, "Let me introduce you to the Teikoku Kagekidan Hanagumi." He turned to the raven-haired, one graying, trio. "General Sakura Shinguchi," he said, indicating the taller of the two women, who had very long hair that, except for its color, reminded Utena of Aunt Belle's. "Her husband, Admiral Ichiro Shinguchi, their daughter Sumire, usually known as Mimi, so as not to be confused with her namesake, Sumire Kanzaki," he went on, shifting his indicating hand to the auburn-haired woman who had spoken earlier. The ash-blonde, faintly sardonic-looking woman in black was next. Detective Chief Superintendent Maria Tachibana. Next to her was a tall, beautiful, elegant girl with wavy gold hair and a uniform jacket to match, and a dazzling smile. La Vicomtesse Iris de Chateaubriand. Then he put his hand on the shoulder of the purple-haired Seleucian girl, whose round glasses and shy smile reminded Utena of Caitlin, and said, "And of course, last but certainly never least, Professor Lee Koran. Everyone, this is Caitlin's roommate, Utena Tenjo."
"Oh," said Mimi Shinguchi, brightening. She looked, now that Utena looked at her more closely, to be about the same age as Corwin.
Utena wondered if she were also part of the group Achika Shen and Riley called the Ragnarok Wave.
"I've really been looking forward to meeting you. I've heard so much about you, how you're practically almost a Valkyrie and everything."
Utena felt herself blush a little and said, "Well, An arm encircled her shoulders from behind, and then Skuld was standing there, grinning.
"Yep," she said, squeezing the pink-haired duelist a little.
"Did Griffin-sensei tell you yet how she humbled him last Christmas?"
Utena felt herself blush a little more and said,
"Skuld?"
"No kidding," said Mimi, looking mightily impressed.
So, for that matter, did her elder namesake, though it didn't show as much on Sumire Kanzaki's look of studied elegance, and her parents.
"That's awesome! What did you do?"
Utena chuckled. I knocked him into the koi pond.
"Right on my butt," Griffin said, nodding. "Shoulder still hurts when it rains."
Utena looked like she was about to apologize for breaking it again, but he diffused that by grinning and winking at her so she knew he was kidding.
"Wow," said Mimi. "That's so cool. Even Mom can't take Griffin-sensei."
"Now, Mimi," Ichiro chided her gently, "they haven't fought in years."
"Maybe we should have a rematch later this week," said Sakura, her eyes twinkling. "Unless you'd rather throw down with Sumire again," she added with a mischievous smile.
Griffin went a little red and coughed. Sumire Kanzaki looked as though she hadn't the faintest idea what the northern barbarian could be talking about,
but her dark eyes were sparkling. Li Koran looked embarrassed, Maria and Ichiro valiantly stifled laughter, and Iris and Skull didn't bother. When they'd recovered, the Norn of Tomorrow turned to Koran, her brow furrowing in mock annoyance. "And you," she said, pointing an accusing finger. Koran shrank back a little bit.
"Me, Professor Ravenhair?" she said meekly.
"Yes, you. You don't call, you don't write. I have to read about your inventions in Gorgeous Ladies of Science Quarterly, just like the rest of the great unwashed. I ask you, is that gratitude? And when are you going to meet another nice young genius, settle down, and start a family? The next generation of genius awaits," she declared, raising an imperious finger. Koran blushed furiously and stammered, Professor, please. Skuld relented, grinning. "Relax, I'm kidding," she said, putting her arm around Koran's shoulders. "You raising kids? The universe quakes with fear." Koran didn't seem to think that was much of an improvement. Still laughing, the Hanagumi scattered into the general melee to mingle for a few minutes before sitting down to dinner. Ichiro Shinguji and Griffin walked together over to the table with the drinks and got themselves a couple of pints of Beltane brown ale. "You're looking well, Ichiro," Griffin observed, raising his stein. "Oh, I get by all right for an old man," Ichiro replied, clinking his own stein against it. "Given any more thought to my offer?" Griffin inquired. Ichiro nodded. "Tempting," he said. "But if what you say about the galaxy's coming troubles is true, then Ishiyama's going to need Sakura and me right where we are." He grinned. "Especially without Peter Moreau around." "Well, let me make you a counteroffer then," said Griffin, undaunted. "We're going to need a presence on the rim, and you know Koran is designing a class of light attack ship for the Space Force anyway. Why not let me deputize the Teikoku Kagekidan? Skuld gives the Hanagumi the test of light, you put the red star on your banner somewhere, we share information, and you go right on doing what you're doing." Ichiro pulled at his beer, then nodded thoughtfully. "Sounds like a good idea to me," he said. "We'll have to clear it with the Emperor, of course, but if Sakura suggested it..." He trailed off, smiling, and Griffin nodded. "Thanks for sending the coal, by the way," he said with a grin. "It was put to a good use." Dinner was a huge, crowded, talkative, festive affair. All the children were on their best behavior, grouped into little gangs by age and prior acquaintance. The eldest group, the duelists and company, just on the edge of adulthood, the Ragnarok wave and their coincidental contemporary, Mimi Shinguji. Miki Kaoru sat with them, eager to make new friends, reminding Utena once again of how young he was, almost a year and a half younger than she was, only a few weeks older than Corwin. Then Pris, Sylvie, Guy, Mirai Morisato, and Mary Broadbank, chatting and giggling over whatever nefarious plan they were hatching lately. The 5-year-olds and younger, the alarmingly precocious Morisato twins, Wapiko Overstreet, Afra Man, and the distressingly precocious Lena Diggers, had their own table off to the corner, with a couple of Skuld's robots and Washu cheerfully chaperoning. Scattered in and among the older kids were all the various adults, deliberately mixing up their separate groups to renew old acquaintances and make new ones. Kay and Skuld noticed with satisfaction that Neil Krummel seemed to have successfully rescued Janice Barlow's knight. The Regolian looked like she was actually having fun now, as she and Neil sat at the end of one of the tables and talked about God knew what. As massive dinner parties go, it was quite a success, and everyone agreed that the various menu items, baked chicken, roast Belgad with snabs, lasagna Asgard, Utena's main contribution to the menu, and so forth, were superb. Afterward, there was an assortment of pies available, ice cream for the kids, and several of the adults, and then the tables were cleared away to open up the Great Hall's floor for dancing. This was the moment Kate had been waiting for all day. With equal parts obvious reluctance and anticipatory glee, she left the sleeping Surge, worn out by all the fun, in the trusted care of Utrina and Wakaba, on a couch Moose McEachern obligingly lugged in from the library, then went to start setting up on the little stage at the far end of the room. While she was doing that, Zoner wandered over to admire, with Fawn chuckling, the sleepy tiger, who was presently curled up in Wakaba's lap, snoring in a way that the auburn-haired duelist found very amusing. While he stood there, he suddenly found himself encircled from behind by arms. This wasn't a totally unheard-of condition, of course, but Yuri was over there, and though Kay had been known to do things like this on occasion, she usually had to have had a few more beers first. Then his embracer released him and rounded him like a corner, and he grinned. "Hey!" he said, and hugged her again, from the front this time. "You made it after all." The new arrival, a very, very pale woman with coal-black hair, jeans, t-shirt, and overcoat, nodded, grinning. She'd apparently just come in from the cold, but Utrina noticed that the bracing outside air had failed to raise a blush in her ash-pale cheeks. She was almost gray, like a Nimbari, a woman in black and white. If it hadn't been for the brightness of her eyes and the cheerfulness of her expression, Utrina would have thought she looked sick. She did look a little harried, but the dark rings around her eyes were makeup. "I can't stay long," she replied to Zoner's delighted announcement. "This is my busiest time of year, more's the pity. But I wanted to stop by and say Merry Christmas, and Dee Dee will stay a couple days if Griff doesn't mind." Griffin drifted over from a laughing exchange with Iris to Chateaubriand. "I heard my name." "Oh, hi, Tell. Glad you could make it." "Griff," said she, giving him a grin and a hug of his own. "Nice party. Glad you're finding the energy to do these things again. Does that mean the job's settling down some?" As she spoke, a grinning Zoner fitted her with his abandoned Santa cap, which somehow fit, and which made for about the most outlandishly incongruous combination of images Utrina could have pictured. "Well, with B5 online and a few months before the new attack ship prototypes are ready for field test, I get a bit of a breather," he replied. "I'm sorry, have you been introduced?" "Oh, duh, sorry," said Zoner. "How rude of me. Talyut, this is Utrina Tenjo, Caitlin's roommate, and her friend Wakaba Shinohara. Utrina, Wakaba, this is Talyut." She looked around, resembling, with his height advantage on most of the crowd, a periscope. "Our daughter Diana is around here someplace." Another very pale girl, like a taller, rangier version of Talyut, wearing a black leather trench coat like the one Zoner commonly affected and the most outlandishly colored pair of tanker's boots anyone there had ever seen, came striding up. "I see you found Dad," she said, grabbing Zoner up in an embrace. "He's not easy to miss, even in a crowd like this," Talyut replied wryly. "Griff, you mind if Dee Dee stays on a couple days here, maybe catches a ride to New Avalon when you all head out?" "Not at all. We missed you last year," he told the taller girl. "I thought you were planning to stop by." "Well, I was," Dee Dee replied, sighing. "But you know how the lanes from the rim get this time of year. I got stuck on New Predonia for a week and a half when the government fell on Christmas Eve. What a pain in the ass." "You never call, you never write," said Zoner fussily. The Art of Noise started tuning up then, and over the noise of Moose tuning his bass, Tell said she supposed Forseti wouldn't be too mad if she stuck around for at least the opening set, but then she really had to get back. The band finished tuning a few minutes later. Down in the little space in front of the stage where the soundboard was set up, Liza Schustal finished making adjustments, gave Kate a thumbs up, and then went around to the little steps, climbed up onto the stage, and started double-checking the wiring. A couple of the musicians fiddled with their instruments. Miki Kaworu, in particular, kept worrying at a little riff until he'd got it right. Beldandy wasn't with them. She stood off to the side, hands folded in front of her, beaming as her apprentice stepped at last into the place she'd held for him. Satisfied with the wiring, Liza smiled around at the assembled musicians, then turned to face the audience, which stopped its burbling undercurrent of chatter and paid attention to the brightly clad blonde figure as she spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen," she said simply into Kate's standing microphone, "the art of noise." Then, grinning broadly, she jumped down from the stage, landing back behind her board, and snapped her headphones into position just as the band started laying down Higher Place. The Art of Noise played 2 sets with a 10-minute break, a short show, but then they didn't get started until nearly 10 o'clock. If there had been any doubt among their friends that Belle had succeeded in her self-appointed task of making a proper rhythm guitarist out of Miki Kaworu, they were laid to rest. Those who had been in Toronto back in March agreed that this show, though much shorter, was easily as well done. By the time they finished, almost bringing down the house with a razor-perfect run-through of I Think I Like It, dedicated to their new engineer, Liza Schustal, it was midnight, and shortly thereafter the party began to break up. Tayud, who had stayed much longer than she expected, ducked out first, noting wryly that Forseti was going to be very cheesed off. But first she extracted a promise from Zoner to visit soon and sealed it with a kiss. The Morisatos packed their sleepy offspring and Mary back through the mirror to Tomodachi and their beds. Many of the other guests took to their ships and the air, filtered back to Beltane spaceport or beamed back to Challenger. Others would be put up at the castle until morning. Within an hour or so of the end of the concert, the party was effectively over. Only a small group of guests, mainly the ones from Ishiyama, and the hosts remained in the library, talking over the issues of the day and making plans for the future. Utina sat on a crenellation at the top of the East Tower, looking up at Saturn, and thought about the day. Christmas had never been much of an occasion for her back in her old life. She didn't have a family, except for Wakaba, and she had a family of her own to spend the holidays with. And it wasn't much fun celebrating a holiday alone. Here, though, here, thanks mainly to Kate, she had a family, one that made this season more fun than it had any business being. There was only one thing missing, and it was on that one thing that she ruminated as she sat and looked up at the ringed planet. "Beautiful, isn't it?" a soft voice asked beside her. She didn't jump, merely turned her head and smiled as the slightly transparent form of Dios sat down on the crenellation next to her. "It is that. I haven't seen you around much lately," she told him. "Our integration proceeds apace," he replied. "You've felt it, haven't you?" She considered, then nodded. "Now that you bring it up, I guess so. I've felt something, anyway, since I visited Asgard." She gazed thoughtfully at his beautiful face for a moment, then said, "You helped me save a dear friend. Thank you." Dios smiled peacefully and sketched a seated bow. "You're welcome," he said, "although I did very little. It was the strength of your heart that saved him. I only gave you the way." "Even so, I couldn't have done it without you." "True, for several interpretations of the phrase. You couldn't have done it without me, because you and I are one." Utina nodded, then smiled a bit sadly and said quietly, "We're not going to get to have many more of these conversations, are we?" Dios shook his head. "No. Every day you grow. Every day, the day when I cease to linger draws near." "I wish there were some way to save you," she said slowly. "Since we started talking back in Toronto, I've come to know you, to like you, and when you're gone, I'll miss you." The ghostly prince smiled beatifically. "Don't grieve for me, Utina. You've already saved me. Because of you, I'll live on in a strong, beautiful, noble person, a worthy successor. My sister will be saved. My world will be protected.
With all that accomplished, I'm content.
He put his hand on her shoulder, solid enough that she could feel its weight and its warmth there, and they both fell silent, looking up at Saturn. A few moments later, the door behind Utrina opened, and there was the sound of shoes on stone as someone emerged.
"Ah, there you are," said Corwin's voice. Sorry, I didn't realize..."
He trailed off, puzzlement obvious in his voice. Utrina turned, surprised, to see him standing in the doorway, about to back through it and return to the castle. Dios, too, turned, looking interested. Corwin looked back, confusion on his face. Then he looked more closely at Dios, and recognition flickered in his eyes.
"I'm sorry," Corwin repeated, lowering his eyes. "I didn't mean to intrude."
Utrina blinked.
You can see him?"
Corwin nodded, then turned to the specter. "Prince Dios, I presume," he said, bowing. "Corwin Ravenhair, of Avalon at Asgard. I believe we met once, although there wasn't time for introductions."
Dios smiled.
"Indeed we did. And I never had the opportunity to congratulate you after that. What you did was well done."
"Thank you."
He turned back to Utrina, who still sat there looking surprised.
"Sorry," he said once more. "I'll go."
"No," she said, holding up a hand. She glanced thoughtfully at Dios, then went on.
Why don't you stay and talk for a while?"
Dios nodded.
"Yes, Sir Corwin, do stay," he said softly. "There's so much I'd like to ask you about this world, and we may not get another opportunity. If I may impose?"
Corwin hesitated in the doorway, looking uncertain. Then he smiled, came back out, and shut the door behind him. Miki Kaworu, still flushed with his first success as a member of the Art of Noise, emerged from the bathroom of the guest quarters he and Dorothy had claimed on their arrival to find himself alone in the room. A note left behind on her pillow informed him that she'd gone for a walk around the compound and would return in an hour or so. Peril, tired out by his very busy day, was curled up in his basket, sleeping peacefully. Miki sat down in the chair next to the basket and regarded the cat with a smile. Peril was looking a lot better now than he had been when Dorothy had adopted him. He'd filled out under her careful attention, becoming sleek and healthy, and his coat had grown in from patchy dullness to an even, soft battleship gray. Despite the fact that he was a foundling, abused and abandoned before his path had crossed Dorothy's, he was a sweet-tempered and playful creature, and apparently fearless, since he'd been undaunted, so far, by trigger-happy soldiers, the destruction of much of the wedge with him in it, spaceflight, or a tiger playmate already twice his size. There was a soft knock at the door. Miki, bare-chested in pajama trousers with a damp towel slung over his shoulders, went to answer it, feeling slightly curious. Dorothy wouldn't have bothered knocking. He considered finding his pajama top, decided it would be ruder to make whoever it was wait until he found it and put it on. Anyway, he was wearing pants, that was the important thing. He went to the door and opened it. Immediately, a soft, warm shape slipped through, pressing against him. A hand splayed across the faintly defined muscles of his slim chest. He took a couple of stumbling steps back as Sylvie Daniels pushed into the room and shut the door behind her.
"Hi,"
she said breathily. Miki blinked.
Hi,
he replied.
"You were terrific tonight," Sylvie told him, backing him toward the bed.
His knees hit the edge, and he sat rather abruptly. She slipped down next to him, her hand still on his chest, and went on,
"You're great. Better than Amanda was. I mean that."
"Thank you," replied Miki equably.
"You're so talented," she murmured, leaning closer. "And smart. And handsome." Miki's brow furrowed, but Sylvie was too busy playing her game to notice. He let her push him down onto his back to keep her busy while he thought, and thought hard, about what she was up to. Since he had met her the previous Christmas, Miki had taken note of Sylvie's playful demeanor, more sensual than a person really ought to be at her age. She and Pris Morgan, her near-constant companion, were both like that, but Sylvie more so. The redhead seemed to have some measure of reserve, or at least she hadn't developed quite this fast. Sylvie was 12, barely starting to make the transition from mere girl to something more, and she sometimes acted as though she were in a great hurry to have that transformation over with. But how much of a hurry was she really in? How much of her seductive play was just that? Play, calculated to make an impression, to shock, to gather amusing reactions. Certainly Miki had provided those amusing reactions last year. He'd been shy, a bit prudish, a perfect stooge for Sylvie's seduction games. But that had been before Azalin. Now he decided to do her a favor. As she leaned down over him, still murmuring compliments, Miki raised his shoulders from the bed, reached up, casually flipped the towel from his own neck to hers, and pulled her down with it, silencing her platitudes with a hard, fierce kiss. She gasped, stiffening, and tried to pull away, but he held her fast, his wiry frame stronger than it looked from constant fencing and dueling exercises. Then, without giving her time to think about it, he rolled her onto her back, his hands on her shoulders, releasing her from the first kiss, and said in a harsh whisper, "I've been wondering how long it would take you to come to me." Sylvie gave a little shriek and writhed beneath his moderate weight, then got a hand on his shoulder and tried to push him off. He held her for a few more seconds to make his point, then let her go. She nearly balled up the covers, recoiling to the other end of the bed, crouched against the headboard, her dark eyes wide. Miki sat up, all composure again. Calmly, he went to the dresser, found a pajama top, methodically buttoned it on, and checked the stopwatch he'd left lying on top of the chest of drawers. Then he turned, walked back to the bed, and sat down on the end, one leg tucked up under him, facing the still shocked girl. "So," he said softly, "I take it you don't actually intend to go to bed with me tonight." Wordlessly, she shook her head. Miki nodded. "I thought not," he said. Sylvie blinked at him, then found her voice. "You thought? Then what was that all about?" "A lesson," he replied simply. "You're not the type to listen to simple words of caution, so I had to show you. It's a dangerous game you play, Sylvie. If I weren't me, if I were someone else, just as charming as you say I am, but more in tune with his baser instincts, and there are such men in the world, believe me, you'd be getting a great deal more than you bargain for right now, and it would leave its mark on you forever." Sylvie flushed scarlet from her hairline down to the notch of her collarbone, revealed by the open-throated blouse she wore, and said nothing. "With me, you're safe," Miki told her. "I'm not interested in conquest for conquest's sake. And call me old-fashioned," he added with a wry little smile, "but I think you're a little too young yet." "But you must be more careful, Sylvie," he told her, his tone more pleading than lecturing. "I'm not saying it's never okay to flirt, but you have to be careful whom you flirt with, and how you do it. Don't put yourself in a situation where you could lose control so easily, not with anyone you can't trust as completely as you can me. Or, well, you've seen how fast it can go wrong." She tried to put on a tough girl scowl, but it didn't quite fit as she said in a too small voice, "I'm not such a pushover. I can take care of myself." Miki shook his head. "There's always someone stronger," he told her. "I'm not saying you have to lock yourself away and live in fear, but..." He sighed as his train of thought got too confusing to articulate, and at the look in her eyes.
I'm sorry. This was stupid. I should have just turned you around and sent you on your way rather than try to teach you a lesson this way. It was high-handed of me. Maybe even cruel. It's just, I've seen the sorts of things that can happen to the careless. It's a harsher world than your life so far has prepared you for, Sylvie, and there are monsters in it. I'm only trying to help.
He closed his eyes, and a tear ran down his cheek, surprising Sylvie out of the last of her shocked paralysis.
Hey, she said softly, crawling nearer. What's that for? I'm sorry. You're right. It was a stupid thing to do. But I thought it'd be funny to see your face, and...
She smiled a little, trying to buck him up, and added,
And it was a pretty nice kiss. Kind of rough, though.
Miki chuckled, opening his eyes again, and wiped the tear away with the back of his hand.
It's for someone else, he explained. Someone, God help me, you remind me of, which is the real reason why, now I think about it, that I did this. Trying to keep you from making the same mistakes.
Sylvie came a little closer, then curled herself into something like a lotus position and asked,
You want to talk about it? I think maybe I owe you one.
He looked at her thoughtfully for a few moments, then smiled, more like his old smile, without the frighteningly cold edge of sardony it had had when he'd played his little charade and frightened her almost out of her skin.
If you don't mind hearing, he said.
Sylvie shook her head.
I won't tell anyone either, she promised. Not even the twins. I can keep a secret, I swear.
Swearing's not necessary, Miki replied with an indulgent grin. Most of my friends know about it, at least the broad strokes, already.
You see, back home, I have a twin sister named Kosue.
Utina said a quiet goodnight to Corwin at the door to his room, backed it up with the usual hug and kiss on the cheek, and went yawning down the corridor. She glanced at her watch and saw that it was nearly 3. Lines of light showed under a couple of the doors. That one was Miki and Dorothy's room, that one Liza and Azalin's, but all was quiet. She reached the door to the room she shared with Kate, noted that there was a light on in there, too, and wondered if Kate was sitting up reading, waiting for her to get back. The thought made her smile. Kate's habit of doing that was one of the traits she shared with Himemia that made life without her a little more bearable. She opened the door, stepped in, then paused on the threshold at a bit of a loss. Caitlin wasn't reading. She wasn't, in fact, awake. She was in bed, curled up, fast asleep, with Seven stationed near her head and Surge in her arms, and Juri next to her, also with an arm over the tiger, her hand on Kate's upper arm. The arrangement, so close and at the same time so completely innocent, was approximately the sweetest thing Utina Tenjo thought she'd ever seen in her life. But it meant she had to find someplace else to sleep. Smiling, Utina changed into her pajamas, then gently removed Kate's glasses, put them on the bedstand, and switched off the lamp. Then, carefully, she went back into the hall and quietly closed the door. As she did so, she noticed someone else doing exactly the same thing, 2 doors down. Dorothy, coming out of the room she'd shared with Miki the night before, in her black and white nightdress. She noticed Utina at the same time, and the two met in the middle.
Dorothy, said Utina softly. Is there a problem? Did you guys, have a fight or something?
No, not at all, Dorothy replied. Miki...
She paused, as if searching for the right wording.
Miki is having a private conversation, she finally decided. I'll sleep elsewhere tonight.
Utina considered this for a moment, then nodded. Dorothy wasn't given to euphemizing. If she said Miki was having a private conversation, then that was exactly what he was having. She wondered with whom, decided it was none of her business, and murmured,
Well, as it happens, I don't think Juri's using her room.